Welcome, everyone, at today's panel discussion. Welcome, Elevate Festival, everyone who's here in the venue, and also everyone on the stream and on Radio Helsinki. So today's panel is called Untrustworthy AI. We'll talk about the trustworthiness of AI and the people who develop it. And, well, you might have noticed artificial intelligence is shaping our daily lives, whether it's on search engines, in large language models, in medical diagnosis, in decision-making processes, all over. So, however, this development raises fundamental questions, and these questions are about the topic of the whole discourse track, trust. Who do we trust? The technology, the people who develop it, the processes behind it. And today we will discuss this with three outstanding experts. We have, I'm delighted to introduce you to our panelists. We have here on the stream Irma Mastenbrück. Irma Mastenbrück is an expert on global AI standards and an activist for queer and feminist tech politics. She advocates for the responsible development of AI and for the implementation of technical standards that promote social justice. And she addresses the question of how technology can be designed fairly to include marginalized groups. We have in the center Dr. Eugenia Stamboliev. Dr. Stamboliev is a media scholar and a technology philosopher. Her research focuses on how trust and mistrust towards AI emerge, particularly regarding discrimination and gender bias. She analyzes the frameworks in society that determine whether AI systems deserve trust. And to my right, or your left, Alfred Ongere. Mr. Ongere is the founder of AI Kenya, an initiative that demonstrates how AI can be used in East Africa as a tool for education, for democracy, and for the fight against corruption. He emphasizes the importance of involving local communities in the design of technologies. So, welcome to all of you. It's great to have you here. So I'd like to start the discussion with questions of trustworthy AI in the sense, is trustworthy AI a reality? Is it a worthy ambition, or is it a total contradiction? Ms. Mastenbrück, you write a lot about technical standards. They are intended to build trust. But are standards really sufficient, or are they more like a means to legitimize existing power structures?
Yeah, I love to see this question pop up. So, because I think what people meant before starting up this trustworthy AI field was that how we were currently doing things is definitely not trustworthy. So the idea is definitely a good idea to increase a lot of transparency and to make sure that companies are in some way liable for when harm is caused by their AI. And like sort of the structure in and of itself of the AI Act is pretty good at that. But I think overall, because the standards are being set by companies mostly, you have to pay access to make standards. So maybe to frame a little bit what is this standard. After the law is written, there is like a European body that's a private company that then invites experts in the European Union to sort of form like, okay, what do we mean when we say safe? Or like, what do we mean when we say non-discriminatory? And those sorts of things are supposed to be like standardized over the whole field. But they, I'm afraid they, because the companies are mostly in charge of setting them, because you pay in order to be an expert to change those standards. And we are joining, for instance, from a civic society spot, which is for free, but there are not so many of those spots available, and then still our time is also not being paid. So eventually you see that the people who are actually having a lot of effect on the standards are like the Googles, Amazons, like Nokias of this world, like big companies who have a lot of capitalist incentive into changing those standards.
So what do you mean is that...
I think indeed the frame or the phrase is, it came from a good place, but I think if corporates are in charge of filling in those gaps, then it's also clear that we will not really get to something trustworthy.
So
I'll now get back to listening.
What do you mean is standards are developed within existing power structures, and you criticize that, right? The standards are developed within existing power structures, like you described with the experts at Google or some other company. And how can we ensure that they are not merely there to reinforce existing prejudice and inequalities?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit hard to specifically say, because sometimes Google or like one of those big tech giants, they will come with actually quite good policy in those conversations. Like, I feel like their contributions are quite good sometimes, because they also have done in the past already a lot of anti-discrimination work, for instance. Mm-hmm. But I generally would say that, and then for them it's nice to have it like the industry standard. But in general, I would say that right now they are like putting less and less focus on diversity programs and stuff like this. So it's pretty clear that if companies are supposed to tell us what is like discriminatory software, for instance, that they're gonna hold a lot of different measuring stick than the civic society would use. Mm-hmm. So I would say it is eventually reinforcing the power structure, because the law is supposed to save us, and then in order, or like to have these companies self-regulate is really, feels kind of naive and pretty empty from us.
Thanks. Dr. Stamboliev, if AI reproduces systematic discrimination, can trust ever emerge, or should be mistrust be the default stance?
So the question is already set up in such a way to say, well, it is discriminatory, so we shouldn't trust it, or it shouldn't be trustworthy. The problem is that at the moment, in the majority of research and in discussions, trustworthiness is defined exclusively, more or less exclusively, when it comes to does it work or does it not work. So it's very functional. And we look also at things like safety, but then we really specifically only talk about, does the algorithm function, does it deliver output? Who it works for is rarely a question. So I think that even for previous power structures, I mean, as Emma perfectly said, you know, it's also who makes the standards, but also who makes the whole technology and for whom. And at the same time, there are different levels of trustworthiness. For instance, what I see now at the same time happening is people who usually are not really profiting from AI in such a way as they're not the norm, still use it, because maybe the function they get out of it is slightly more important than what they lose. So it's actually a bit of a complex question in should we or should we not use it. But the philosophical idea behind it, and that's also my main work, is that AI has to be and is trustworthy, and the way to get there is to make it function properly in a way of operational systems. But we do not discuss so much who does it work for and should it be untrustworthy.
Mm-hmm. So trust in a complex AI system, we have expectations, and are these expectations misplaced when you say, okay, we only care for the for it functioning properly, but the consequences of it working in a certain way, that's too complex for us to understand, I sometimes feel.
Yeah, this can happen. I mean, it always depends on the AI system in use, of course. But the second you talk about AI, which is always a big infrastructure, you will have certain people not getting the results they deserve. But at the same time, maybe we should make a difference between AI systems that are used by someone, or at least we think so. I actually don't believe that. I think AI uses us, and not we use AI. But there's also systems that we see and systems we don't see. So usually in the background of governmental systems, company systems, that's a sort of AI that is not in our control. So if we trust it or not, it actually doesn't matter, because it's going to be used upon us, basically. And now we're, of course, in this slight illusion that we are using things like ChatGPT, but even they are partially also using us. But here the efficiency question just became so dominant that trust became now merged with efficiency. And if we see, well, it spits something out and saves me time, then sure, why not trust it?
So that illusion and that trust that we put into technology, Mr. Ongare, you work in Kenya. Is this trust we put into technology here also a phenomenon in the global south? Or is there a different approach to AI?
So speaking for... Okay. Is it working?
Yes.
Okay. So speaking for the global south, and particularly Kenya, surprisingly, it's the other way around. A report from Edelman, the Edelman Trust Barometer, they do global reports on different topics of trust, and particularly on AI. They found out that developing nations have more trust in AI as opposed to developed nations. So countries like India was standing at 77%. Nigeria, I think 76%. And then the United States of America was at 32%, right? So this really now brings a fresh perspective, and it breaks the normal belief that, you know, developing nations trust AI less. And this is because for developing nations, we see AI as a tool for progress, or just technology in general, as a tool for progress to solve and improve different aspects of life. But then in the developing nations, it's sort of seen as more of something that creates more anxiety around different aspects of life. So just in summary, for us, we are really focused on how can we use AI to improve healthcare? How can we use it to improve access to education and business and so on?
Yeah. So you see it as a tool, and because you see it as a tool, you shift your focus also on local participation. So
yes,
you can build your own innovations on top of AI or with AI.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that in a minute. Maybe let's shift the focus to the responsibility and the ethics of AI. It's often marketed as a solution to problems and not always to local problems. But to what extent does a global AI application or companies like OpenAI, Google, and all these companies, to what extent do they pose the risk of a kind of digital colonialism?
I would say there's a very huge risk. So in terms of digital colonialism, I look at it from the perspective of digital independence. So can you really operate normally if these solutions are taken out? Unfortunately, most of the technologies we build in the global south depend on either open source technology that mostly coming from the West, or just commercial API solutions that are coming from the West. So, and when you look at an aspect of language, we still haven't gotten to that high level of specialization where we have our own local languages being realized in these different tools. So particularly for ourselves, we are working on how can we build solutions that I can talk to a smart assistant in Swahili, which is one of our national language, or in my local mother tongue language. We are not yet there, or if you are there, most of these solutions are not widely accessible to maybe even someone here in Austria. So working on language is a very, very critical area that will really bring a shift in terms of breaking those barriers of digital colonialism. But just to answer your question, yes, there's still a very huge barrier and a lot of dependence on Western technologies.
Mm-hmm. And it's not about language only, it's also about cultural context, about ethical frameworks.
Yes.
How do you start working on that? You've been doing this for a while now.
So it's really just focusing on the foundations. So it's either two approaches, that you start building entirely from scratch, or we leverage the existing frameworks and open source tools and then build upon them to sort of transfer our cultural or language aspects to it. So we've been, education and capacity building has been one really main pillar in doing that. So doing workshops and trainings and emphasizing on the standards of how to build different aspects of the technologies, and just pushing the ecosystem to, and particularly the private institutions, to invest more in local research and development, so that we are starting to see solutions from the region as opposed to importing solutions all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Irma Mastenbrück, how do you think can international standards that you talked about earlier be adapted to local cultural contexts, and doing that without reinforcing neo-imperialistic tendencies?
It's a bit hard for me to hear the full scope of the question, but I think I got it. It's hard for me to really answer this, because I think that it already, just to shape the technology as we now see it, there has been a lot of like modern slavery or exploitation of the global south just to already get where we now are. Like, I feel like the hands of AI in that sense are kind of dirty. So a good example of this might be like the data labeling practices that were done in like pretty rough circumstances under things that were later seen as modern slavery. And I would say that the way in which the technology eventually is deployed tends to, the people who are taking this technology and using it are going to find an advantage from using it. For instance, like, let's say that you are planning to automate a large part of your services, then you can lose a lot of your employees that you might have employed abroad, you know? So I think in that sense, I find it difficult to ever cut it really loose from modern day imperialism, because it's largely Western companies that are doing these things. But I will say, for open source technology, it's not as clear cut who benefits the most. I think it is a lot more democratized who benefits from open source technologies. So I'm not sure if I fully got to the core of your question with this answer.
I think you did, but I just remembered one thing I believe you wrote about once, the European Union's artificial intelligence regulation, where it sets guidelines for AI use in Europe. And you gave that as an example how different legal frameworks don't always fit for... that it's bad to have a one-size-fits-all approach to social and political contexts that differ so widely all over the world. So do you think that regulators should be more aware of that, even when they make a law that's for Europe? Think more globally, or how do you think society should approach that?
Yeah, I think specifically the European legislation is actually there with a quite European-centric view, quite deliberately, I think, because they, in their political agenda, they care most about not losing the AI arms race from the US and China. So their idea is like, why don't we position ourselves as sort of this like third thing that's like not government suppression and also not capitalism, like without boundaries, but we are like the regulator of the three. But I think it's in a sense not, they focus most of their energy on making sure that the European consumer is safe. So if a product causes any harm to a European citizen, then they are like liable for this, or they're supposed to be doing something about that. So I don't think that they have in their concept that they would like to also think about the rest of the world. I think even more so, it's like a legislation that they built in order to like win from those places in the world. But I will say that like in general, my perception of the regulation field in general is that it's pretty easy to communicate from one country to another. You can already see that like the European AI Act is largely copied by other smaller companies or other smaller countries who are who want to have safe legislation, and they end up making the same type of rules. So I'm not sure if the rules in and of themselves like really show European values, but you could see how it could be very difficult for companies to implement them in different parts of this world, because even within Europe there's a difference between how like a Polish person looks at gay marriage versus like a Dutch person. And there has to be like an answer that comes from these machines when you talk about gay marriage, for instance. So it's like pretty difficult to see exactly like, okay, what is harmful in which context. And yeah, but the law itself is quite broad. It will just say like, do no harm. So I think if you can justify that whatever the thing is that is harmful is harmful, for instance, abroad, then maybe there is a way to do something about that. And it, like European law now says specifically that it wants to protect human rights and the environment. So if you can show that something is like violating human rights abroad, or if it ruins the environment in the global south, then they probably are still liable under the European AI Act to do something about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Stamboliev, is the European AI discourse dominated by Eurocentric norms?
You mean the one in Europe?
Yeah.
Yes.
And globally? And globally, do you think?
Sorry?
And globally, the Western focus on Western values?
It's slightly tricky to speak me as a European scholar for the global focus of AI. And I wouldn't be representative to do that. What I know from colleagues of mine who then work on different kinds of AI, and Alfred, you perfectly mentioned it, we have a very Euro-Western-centric focus on AI or on technologies. And there's also amazing stuff happening in India or in other African countries and so on, where people develop their own technology. And I've heard from a colleague of mine in the Netherlands, actually, she once also warned that we have to be careful with our skepticism, because it's a privileged position, you know, to be skeptic and to say I don't want this, because sometimes we don't need it. But for some people, AI is of course an economic question too. So so how do you balance these things? Yeah, how do you balance at the same time saying, well, still it's not okay for companies to go to specific African countries like Kenya and to exploit people to prompt or to safeguard their technologies. And can I just add a little anecdote, because it's funny that you talked about language. So there was a Guardian article, I think, maybe half a year, a year ago, about finding out that certain words in ChatGPT are very kind of interestingly not really the norm in the US or UK, certain English words. And then they traced it back and they tried to figure out why. So we didn't really put it in as training data. And then it turns out that the labelers in the country are using actually these words specifically. So basically it's a Kenyan English word, and yeah, then it comes up often. I mean, it's almost like an interesting thing to see. It's a circle of things, like AI is not one country. It's always many, many, many things. The natural resources as well, like AI is not made by US. It actually has so many material things in it that are from other countries. And of course, as Irma already said, the idea of regulation, it's a market issue. It's not a human rights discussion. It's about regulating markets. And this is what the EU does and will do and can do, and maybe even not perfectly, but at least they're going to try to do that. But it's not about human rights. Like, and they have, for instance, for some who are more interested in policy, but they really put in a paragraph or certain articles about having to declare how much energy you need for your AI. But then they didn't put in the limits. So you can say it and then good luck, move on. So what's the point if you don't have limits then? So you have to put it in, but no one decided on what's allowed and where to go. Or for instance, they do not talk at all about workers' rights or things like that. Because yeah, apparently it's not really a topic for to be regulated.
Mm-hmm. So how could this be disrupted to have more of aspects like workers' rights in the models, in the frameworks, in the language models and all that? Do we need a discourse where we focus on the values that don't seem so close to us to implement other cultures' views into AI models?
I mean, this becomes slightly problematic because it's not European tasks to start to regulate other countries' AI. There's another element of colonialism here, because we then say, well, we're going to protect you, don't worry. But I get your point, you know, it's very important, and at the same time we cannot really, there are certain limits as well in how much you can get involved in other countries, other continents, or other fields.
That's already happening. We are using software that comes from Silicon Valley, and so why not think about different approaches here in Europe? I mean, that's what the what the European laws are trying to do. I'm just questioning whether they do it correctly.
I mean, there are several discussions here. For instance, is AI going to be something that big? Is this going to continue? And I actually think maybe not, because the environmental costs are, the first thing that is already like really not sustainable, and this is not going to be working. At the same time, we're running out of data, or of human data, because ironically, in all these discussions, human data is one of the most valuable things. There are initiatives now in Europe, of course, focusing also more on smaller products. But the problem with AI is it's inherently something very big. But maybe we have to go away from the big and just, I don't know, discuss algorithmic systems or digital systems.
Yes, smaller systems. And that's where you, Alfred Ongere, come in again. How can it be ensured that local communities are co-creators of AI systems and not just beneficiaries?
So one of the ways, first of all, is ensuring that the community has decision makers. So the community has to be sort of a cross-functional mix of different professions. So you must have someone in government there, you must have someone from the big tech, you must have someone from the startup, and also some researchers in there, and having the discourse that we are now, discourse like this, to bring the conversation now from this level to now the decision-making rooms, where at the end of the day the regulations are decided, at the end of the day the standards are decided. So it's coming to that realization that you can't build in a silo or in a vacuum. At the end of the day, you have to involve yourself and participate actively. And it also now shifts from just building a tech community of software developers and machine learning engineers to a community that has everyone, a community that has a researcher from academia, a community that has a lawyer, and so on, so that at the end of the day, when we are having these discussions, everyone's voice is heard, and then we trickle that down to now their decision-making rooms. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can it trickle down when there is not a lot of insight and transparency into how the systems that you're going to use actually work? Because we always have this fear now of the, okay, you can explain the source code, you can put it on the web and it's open source, and you can explain how the software works, but nobody really understands what these millions and millions of neurons in the artificial neural network really do and how it comes to decisions. So there's always this fear of a black box. So how can you have real participation and transparency when people don't actually understand how the AI works?
I personally share a different view, and I think science proves this. With time, that narrative was there from the beginning, that AI was a black box, and that narrative is mostly being pushed by the media. We have so many scientific conferences and summits where we tackle different layers of how to build the technology. So I think explainability in AI is an area that has already been solved to a large proportion. There's still a small proportion that is being worked on in terms of alignment and so on. But the major aspects of how this system makes decisions is a question we've already answered. And the fact that we've answered the questions, it now then trickles down to innovation breakthroughs, such as what DeepSeek is doing by using less compute to build more powerful system. I mean, DeepSeek wouldn't have achieved that if AI is a black box, right? So at the end of the day, AI is just so many layers of software. So it's about picking one layer, understanding what it's doing, and then optimizing it. But we always have to watch out and, you know, correct the media or you know, stakeholders that want to ride on the narrative and create an illusion that this area has not been solved, because for them, at the end of the day, it's marketable. I mean, that's what gets them the clicks, that's what gets them paid, and so on. So we've really significantly solved the explainability and transparency problem around AI. It's sad that some organizations, they don't tend to put resources in that area. So in their software development lifecycle, they'll decide, okay, they'll skip the part for explainability and transparency, and they'll just focus on, okay, this is what our solution does, how do we scale, how do we make more money, how do we help our customers. But at the end of the day, the tools are there. We just have to pick them and build. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ms. Mastbrak, explainability and transparency, how realistic is that in a highly complex AI system?
Could I maybe add something to this? About the transparency, because I wrote my thesis back in 2019 on explainable artificial intelligence. And I, at the time, as a mathematician, was looking at the technologies that were currently available to do that. And in my opinion, the black box was basically just used two ways very often. So it's like, oh, we don't really know why this AI is telling you to amputate your leg based on your medical record, for instance. And then if you ask the question of why should I do it, you often use like the same structure that you don't really know that much about, and then choose to trust whatever comes out of that explaining function. But I, as a fundamental question, started asking like, shouldn't we also now have some form of a metric for like how good of an explanation this explanation is? And then if we find a function to do that, then that function has the same sort of fundamental problem. So yes, okay, you can poop out different explanations, But then how do we justify that for sure that is a good explanation of the situation? We don't really know that. And in a way, you touch like really deeply onto the philosophical meaning of truth. Like, when do we know something for sure? Or like, when is it explained? Even that as like philosophical questions is pretty difficult to answer. And it's not a question that like programmers tend to ponder a long time about, because they're just like, you asked for an explanation and here there is one. So, you know, and but I think the transparency that is asked for by the law is also often like a type of transparency of like letting the people know that AI is being used on their data, or like transparency around like their governance. So how are they trying to combat structural inequality, things that are ingrained in bias, for instance, and like having to show something on the record, like, okay, we have tried to do something about it in these and these ways, is a type of transparency that can be required. But I think when you look specifically for explanations of AI, it's philosophically really hard to justify that that is the explanation, I think.
So what is meaningful explainability? It's not enough to open source a model or a software, and we need to challenge that, I think. What is real transparency and real explainability? That's what I'm trying to get to here. Dr. Stamboliev, to what extent must transparency be coupled with some sort of accountability?
Well, to a full extent, but at the same time, even with zero transparency, there must be full accountability. So let's not mistake that accountability can be just skipped. And this is the biggest problem at the moment. The big companies don't want to be accountable for certain things. That's one of the major issues why things are so complicated. It's so interesting for me, though, that Irma also worked on explainability, like myself, for a while. And here I saw like another trap that is very popular. So explainability is a research field in mostly data science and computer studies where people realized, oh wow, we cannot know what AI does, so let's find models to explain it. Those models can be AI as well, so it can be AI explaining AI, or it can be text or visual or whatever. However, I worked once with a case study in the Netherlands, actually, because it was a huge scandal. It was a child care benefit scandal where people didn't know. Yeah, I'm nodding because it really became one of those case studies, unfortunately, where people were discriminated upon not receiving child care and being also penalized to on taxes, because the taxes and the child care were linked. And this went on for over 10 years. And then research comes in and says, well, of course, it was a black box. We didn't know what was happening. And it was, you know, but then in the end, it was very clear what was happening. A feature was used that shouldn't have been used, which was nationality. That was a human error. And that was a very clear thing which you could have avoided. So the AI, or back then, actually, it's not AI even. It was just algorithmic system. It did what it was supposed to do. So the black box would have been, we allow for certain discriminations to happen, and we actually, well, making this transparent is very difficult. You cannot really tell people, well, this is going to discriminate you, so, but please use it. So, and I struggle with that. And one thing I learned from this case was, you can explain as much as you want. You can make things as transparent as you want. Of course, companies won't do that. That's another thing. But they can tell you the algorithm. They can tell you all the teeny tiny technical details. They won't tell you their business model. They won't tell you their value systems, because very often they're intuitively just being made and done. And one thing that is lacking, and this is for me an authority problem, if someone explains something to you, and you just have to accept it without having any way to say, I refuse this, or I want out, then explanation and transparency is for nothing, because there's no way of empowering people to get out of these things. And this, for me, is the bigger problem. Mm-hmm.
And then, going back to accountability, what kind of structures do we need? I think you wrote about accountability structures once. Mm. What do you mean by that?
I mean, the idea with accountability is mostly legal as well. I wish it would be ethical or philosophical, but when it comes to markets and profits, it's not really. The thing with AIs, it's not even one thing. It's not one technology. Again, it is a network and an infrastructure. And tracing back accountabilities is very, very problematic. Because practically it's very difficult. And at the same time, you can always go back to the CEO and say, well, I don't know, Elon Musk did it. And then, okay, but he didn't do it alone. Like, there are so many people below him supporting the system. Mm. And there are no legal requirements to make certain systems really transparent. And again, just the algorithm in itself, that's our very crazy focus of believing. I mean, I also
who put in the racist algorithm, and where did it start, and how do you, how do you find that person or the process that was behind that?
Exactly. Yeah, and it's a very tech focus, but tech not in a good definition. Tech in a very simple reductionist definition. When we say, well, the algorithm is the black box. Yes, but the algorithm is also a social system, an economic system.
And it's made by people.
Yeah, it's about people.
So that would lead us to the fourth kind of chapter I have in my head, trust in technology versus trust in people. So is trust in technology itself a misplaced focus as AI decisions become increasingly automated? Who bears responsibility, the developers, the companies, or society? Maybe I'll give that question to Irma Mastenbrück first.
Yeah, I like this question because it's like the sort of the topic of my presentation that I give to companies, where I show techie, who like we follow a sort of techie's journey, and techie wants to program something socially acceptable and ethical. But then is struggling a lot with, the definitions of success are set by the corporation, and the law is written by someone completely different. And it is really difficult for techie to like understand who to listen to. And if you don't watch out, it will be the capitalist incentives that are always going to steer the outcome most, I think. Like, for instance, let's say that we try to find out what is even a discriminatory outcome of something, then like a very loose definition might in the end win, because it's easier for companies to sell by it. So I think in the end, if you look at who has the capability to do something, then it's very often only the computer programmer. But to ask them to solve like the biggest philosophical, ethical issues of this day and age is quite ridiculous, right? So we need to have more people on board. Like in a best case scenario, you have an extremely large sort of group of people, largely coming from civic society or people who are affected by these models, that get to say something about what a good ethical model would look like. But I think what it looks like now is that companies get to set their own like standards, and eventually, like a programmer is only an employee of the company, like in the end, they don't really have different incentives.
Mm-hmm. And
except if they really want to, like as a person. But yeah, it looks like it's mostly them who can do something about it. But it's way too difficult to ask them to solve that issue. And it's also like a very narrow demographic. Like programmers are very often men from privileged backgrounds. Mm-hmm.
And it's often
also not very diverse.
You can't hear me. It's often a small group of very powerful people or entities that want us to trust them. And that makes it so problematic, right? Do we need more public engagement and oversight to ensure that AI serves society rather than these small, powerful entities? And how can we achieve that? It's incredibly difficult, I think, right now to even have that discourse, even when laws are being made, because of these companies that are pushing out their platforms and their applications and dominate the space with their opaque algorithms, right? So how can, maybe that's a question for you, Dr. Stamboliev, how can trust be built when we are like, is our trust misplaced because AI is not neutral? And I'm not sure how I want to ask this. How can the technological processes be trusted when we don't know the people behind them? Because we don't really know them, right? We know some corporate entities, but nobody talks to the programmers and to the developers, right?
That's a difficult one. But before answering it, and I do kind of have an answer, I would like to say something else about kind of the introduction of this round of questions. I don't think that the dualism is between human and technology. I really like technology, and I think making technology is a way of cultural engagement with our knowledge. I think it's between power and non-power. So it's never the human. Because the human, also something we are deconstructing at the moment in philosophy for a reason, the human has been hundreds of years white, male, Eurocentric. And also the technology. There was times I remember when technology was also fun and you could experiment and you could do more things. And now I keep talking only about corporations. And I also do believe that there's still lots of technology out there that is actually in a good way being used. With AI, it just, because it's in itself, like a colleague of mine in the UK, Dan McQuillan, he actually calls AI a fascist media in itself. So it's built up in such a way, at least the big things, that it's all about power. You have to have the power to make it. And who has the power to make it? Of course, the powerful. But it's not about humans or not.
When you ask who has the power, you are asking for persons or for powerful entities that we talked about. That sounds so abstract.
Yeah.
I mean,
who but are... But users as well.
Yeah.
Like, if we wouldn't use ChatGPT, it wouldn't, be so successful. But I get it. You cannot then blame individuals. One of the issues I have at the moment is discussions are shifting into debates of individual responsibility. You know, be more literate. You know, you have to know how to use it, prompt better. Mm-hmm. But this will not stop you from being discriminated because in the background, the companies do what they want. So it's not about constant protection. And I see a certain distrust, and this is for me a huge problem, that... It spreads within society, but also into other discussions like media trust or political trust, expertise trust. And these things are really intertwined. They're not really separate. And I'm not sure. So with trust, it's a very strange concept because you can mistrust in a productive way. You can be skeptical towards something, which is good, or you can be reactionary and just distrust serious traditional media.
So should we foster the trust into institutions that regulate AI?
I do not foster anything. I do not foster trust as such. Don't trust. No, I'm kidding. I think it depends on institution. There's a certain guidelines or certain questions to challenge institutions constantly. And this is a good thing because this is how we develop and become better. The issues are actually much more banal sometimes. It's, for instance, at the moment, bureaucratic issues between regulation, companies, and citizens that are really making things so complicated. It's rarely about someone sitting there and being, not trustworthy because they want to be the evil guy who or whatever takes over. So and practically speaking, as long as we find use in something, we will use it. And this will override maybe other problems. But at the same time, let's see how long certain technologies will also be there. I mean, at the moment, I think we're in a kind of bubble and hype, especially with chatbots. And let's see how long they're going to really function. And for me, that will be the actual really interesting time when they start to go completely crazy, because they will, if we let them, you know, if we let synthetic data take over, which is data produced of AI for AI, and if we take out the human control, then it might become like a performance piece, but not anymore really what we expect at the moment, informative, truthful, blah, which is anyway not happening because LLMs are not made to be truthful. This is just, I don't know, a media discussion that went completely out of control. So yeah, and for me, this is then the idea of when it becomes interesting and where the companies will lose interest. Unfortunately, then they will lose interest, but for us it might be more interesting because it will become a bit more maybe hackable even, you know? Mm. So yeah, it really depends. But I think we're very early on. I think AI will break into different fragments.
Mm-hmm. It will break into different fragments, and as the hardware gets better, we will be able to run our own LLMs on tiny, small machines. Right now you need like 5 or 6 PCs with a dozen video cards to run a decent LLM, I think. But it will get more efficient. And is that a part of the story, to have these AI models running in every household locally?
Oh God,
it's kind of scary. Yeah.
Okay, not sure that's my conclusion.
I don't know. I mean, it's.
But I'm not sure if you know. I'm honestly, like, there is a certain tendency. Even, I mean, AI is a narrative. Yeah, it's a story. Even us saying artificial intelligence might just change in a few years. We might go back to other terms, and then also LLMs. I mean, large language models. You might not need large language models. You might be happy with smaller ones. Yeah. We might get other things, and I'm not speaking about, you know, chips in your brain or something, because these discussions also distract massively from certain things. And again, I do believe that energy and water consumption will really play into these debates massively, and that even companies might be more regulated or get out of certain markets. And maybe a last thing to finish on. LLMs or chatbots at the moment, they're not really lucrative. So they're not gaining back the money that's being invested, which means it's not quite clear, I mean the big ones, it's not quite clear how long companies are going to continue to really invest in that. Especially, I mean, there's a reason why the US does it, because they have so much speculative capital and they can do that. And every time I hear people in Europe, oh, but why don't we have our own? Well, because we don't just get out, I don't know, so much money into certain applications, because you take it away then from social maybe services, yeah, and from other things. And this is not how Europe is constructed. So there's a reason for that. And I do hope that we will talk more about niche discussions and a bit more local debates on maybe not AI technology.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the topic of trust and constructive trust in AI, Mr. Ungheri, you focus a lot on the aspect of education. Yeah. And what role does education play in fostering critical and constructive trust in AI?
So education plays a very foundational role in determining how people perceive AI or just technology. If you don't understand something, you will tend to fear it, right? If you don't understand how a technology works, if you don't understand how you can contribute to a certain part of the value chain for technology, you will tend to not trust it. So education is very, very important for people to know how they can influence and change the narrative. So how can I use technology to improve my personal life? How can I use technology to create more job opportunities? How can I use technology to drive better legislation for different areas? So education is very, very important, and not just education of the technical professions, but also the non-technical aspects, such as research, law, and so on.
Say that again. Such as?
Research, law,
okay.
And so on.
Yeah. Can you give an example for that?
Yes, so for us at AI Kenya, we run different programs, both technical and non-technical. The technical ones are the typical coding workshops on how to build different AI technologies such as credit scoring systems. It so happens today is actually back in Kenya. We are running a 3-day hackathon on using LLMs to build solutions for scientific discovery. So how can we accelerate the scientific discovery process for scientists by using LLM? So it has been a 3-day hackathon. We've been doing hackathons for the past 6-7 years as a way of not only upskilling people on how to use AI, but also to solve problems for different organizations that they have. We also have public screenings where we watch a documentary on a certain topic, and we invite people from different professions to come and discuss how that technology is affecting lives. We have showcases of startups that are building solutions using AI. And then lastly, of course, we have events like this, town halls, where we invite people to discuss different aspects of the technology. And then, of course, we are working on training programs for different levels, whether it's high schoolers, whether it's the CEO, the corporates, whether it's the software developer or the marketer in the organization. So education is really a critical part. Yeah.
So at the hackathons, are the participants, first of all, how many people go to the hackathons? How large are they in Kenya?
Right now, the one we have has about 37 participants. Now, these are data scientists and machine learning engineers. But in the room, we have observers, scientists who use these tools, about 10 or 15 of them.
And do they use AI tools to develop software, or do they write AI applications at the hackathons? What's the goal?
I'd say they do both. Right now, as a software developer, if you want to work at the normal pace of innovation and build faster, you are using different aspects of AI. Whether it's in GitHub Copilot or you're just using a notebook that allows you to just describe what you want and then it codes it for you and then you're able to change different specific parts. So it's sort of a mix of both. You are doing it in the traditional way or you are using AI to build other AI solutions. Yeah.
Thank you for those insights and perspectives. We have 25 minutes left. I would like to invite the audience to join the discussion.
Can I add something very, well, philosophically here, because you kind of mentioned it briefly, and it's not really to discredit your points, but it's interesting, in philosophy, there's this understanding that actually trust and knowledge don't really go in proportions to each other. So the more you know, the less you trust. And this is something to keep in mind sometimes with certain discussions, because not that I'm against, I'm totally for education and knowledge, of course, that's out of question, right? It's also with human beings. So the more you want to know about something, the more you're kind of, what's happening? So this is also like a completely kind of wrong idea of the more we know about AI, the more we will trust it. I think the more we know, maybe the less. Here we can see the technical discussion is guiding this mostly, so we don't really know about other things that are happening, and this is definitely a problem.
Yeah, that's a good starting point for the open discussion, I think. I'd like to invite you. Please briefly introduce yourself and keep your questions concise. We have 24 minutes.
Oh, thank you very much for this great discussion and all those different insights, but I have to pick up on this. Yeah, exactly, the point. Is it more trust and more knowledge or not? And I'm glad that you actually brought up one of the underlying currents that me as a discourse organizers have a trust altogether, this issue that in philosophy there is this understanding that knowledge and trust are disconnected, or rather in the proportion that the more you know, the less you trust. In psychology, it's the different position, the evidence we have, and this is of course a bit of a difference between psychological and philosophical approaches altogether, is that it is the more you know, the more, for instance, you know about politics and how they work, you can actually see in behavioral studies that people are more engaging, for instance, in the democratic action. Same goes for pro-social activity, that acting really towards an ideal of a society that collaborates is also being shown in people with higher actual knowledge of themselves, but also knowledge of how, for instance, social interactions are running. So it's funny that, in fact, probably, and even if you drive through all those 3 days of the discourse program, we will not get to a final answer. Is it more trust with more knowledge or less trust? To pick up on the point by Alfred Ongere and all the examples you're giving, I also heard in an interview that you and your organization was giving that you were engaging in trust-building measures by actually unmantling some of the hidden secrets or structures in Kenyan policy or politics. And I would really like to hear a bit more on how there more information was a tool for more trust, but not trust in a naive and passive way, but in actually engaging in again, in more cooperative behavior or political, I don't know, democratic activation in a way. Yeah, thank you.
Can I just jump in into the first part? I don't think it's necessarily like the law, you know, the more you know, the less you trust. But there is this, a field of research that conference. Really looks into the discussion that your impulse to want to know more is sometimes based on you not trusting enough. Because, but then it's linked to belief systems, like what's knowledge, what's belief, how does trust play into that? Mm-hmm.
To your question, so in our country, last year, we had a financial bill that was being proposed by Parliament. This financial bill was very controversial because it was introducing some new policies that would make livelihoods very expensive for the normal citizen. A certain group of the youth between 18 to 30 decided to educate the wider public on exactly what this bill was talking about and how it would affect people. And so technology really played a very crucial part in terms of leveraging tools such as Twitter to talk about the bill, TikTok to talk about the bill. But most interesting enough, one particular person took the bill and created a custom GPT on ChatGPT and invited people to query and ask, okay, I'm a farmer, how will this bill affect me if it is passed? And then the system is able to answer. So at the end of the day, the farmer becomes more empowered and able to talk to the next person and tell them, okay, this bill is very bad. Please talk to the member of parliament so that we don't pass this bill. So it created a very, very big effect in terms of influencing the members of parliament not to vote for the financial bill. So in a sort of way, it amplified... instead of having one fluent person who is explaining the bill to each and every person, they have limits. We had a system where, 10,000 people, 5,000 people could access it at the same time and ask different things and then get empowered then at the end of the day. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for the great talks. For European regulation, where should the focus go, or where the funding, when we get another 100, 800 billion for AI, where should it be invested?
Was this towards me? Oh God, I'm not an investment specialist. I have no overview on all the markets that are there. So it's a really almost impossible question for me to answer because...
Public funding from the EU should go in which direction? As well, regulation should go in which direction?
It will go into all kinds of businesses and many things that actually get funding and also quite good and where I get on board that they use AI. Is actually, in environmental sciences or in waste management, you know, things that are not so sexy to be discussed, like, ooh, ChatGPT, but where it actually makes sense not only to fund, but to also use AI, maybe. But these things don't really come into public discussions. At the same time, I think it should definitely go into smaller businesses and whatever, I don't like the word startup, but let's call it startups. However, there's a bit of a problem now that I'm not quite sure that the AI regulation is going to do certain smaller companies really a huge favor, because certain things are becoming increasingly also difficult for them. I'm a huge fan of the AI Act, which is a huge regulation now in Europe, but I fear, as usual, that the big companies will find ways to sneak through and to get out of certain things, and then the smaller won't, and this again will make the divide even bigger.
Are there any more questions? Yes.
I do think maybe I'll have something to say about the regulations being like not so good for the the innovation of the continent. But I believe maybe it's actually something that we complain more about than we kind of should, because product legislation has been a thing in Europe since the beginning of, maybe 100-something years. And it's like the type of regulation that will make sure that we have safe cars and safe roads. And like there is a regulation around, if you want to bring like a toaster on the market, you're gonna have to test your toaster if it catches fire, if it's like safe to use. And the AI Act is largely based on this type of regulation, right? So it's largely like you're not supposed to bring anything to the market that can like seriously harm people. And yes, okay, you need to do some administration to check and to show that you have been doing those things. But I think it makes a lot of sense that you cannot just throw things onto the market without checking if they work for everyone, if there are any dangers that are connected to it. And in the sort of broader scope of things, I'm like, okay, maybe it's a little bit harder for companies to kind of get started, but these are questions that you should ask yourself anyway if you want to make a good product that does well. So it's like a little bit, maybe you get a little bit less of the Wild West situation that the US is getting themselves into, where it's like, let's just make everything and then let companies get like really filthy rich. The their stakeholders are all super happy with the return of interest, for instance. But then, like, first, a lot of harm needs to happen to society before we start making any like law against that. So I don't know. For me, even if it's smaller companies, and like you're still a company, you have still have a lot more money than the rest of us in a way. So then, like, yeah, you should make sure that you make products that are safe enough for the market. That's kind of like, I don't really see how that stifles innovation, as more so that it like protects companies from growing outside
the nation. I mean, actually, yeah, I'm 100% with what you just said. Oh, sorry, I think we overlapped. Are you hearing us? Okay. So I don't think regulation and innovation are contradictory. That's a really crazy thing that companies just invented to fight against regulation. But the things are becoming increasingly complex. For instance, US companies and certain US, infamous or famous people now intervening into European regulation, intervening into European democratic systems to destabilize certain regulatory bodies. So these things are actually much more of an issue than the idea of let's have regulation or not, because also most things with AI are already being regulated anyway. So for instance, there's the Digital Service Act. It regulates so much. It covers lots of things that the AI Act would have done. But the kind of overall discussion I'm having sometimes with smaller businesses is as well, how can we find ways not to be so dependent on US services? So that's actually really a bit of an issue, like how are we gonna be a bit more independent? Can we be, or do we have to just agree now, okay, well, the big players take it all, and then suddenly we're all just implementing it?
Mm-hmm. I think we had one more question in the front row here. Several more.
So this goes a bit into the area of AI and education, because one of the things that I've seen how useful AI can be is with languages. So especially I use a software for reading back texts, and for instance, it has got voices, languages that aren't available on the market with usual audiobooks. And I was wondering, how do you guys think will AI be used in future, for example, reestablishing or teaching languages that are at the brink of extinction?
Can take that. I think AI will play a very, very critical role. The aspect that you can train a system and then make it accessible, and it doesn't even need to be on the internet. You can just lock it on a server and move around the country and make sure it is accessible to different people. So it will play a very critical role in helping us to preserve the languages that are not widely spoken, but we would want future generations to tap into. So I see language in different forms. So whether it's just translating, and even walking around the street here, and I don't speak German, so it would be good to have a live transcription solution that is more accessible and more cheaper that you can use as you talk to people. When you interact with movies, I think we need to get to a time where you go to the cinema and you choose what language you want to hear the film in. Do you want in the original language, or do you want to automatically switch to another language? So in 10 or 5 seconds, it should generate the entire film in the language that you want to work with. And whether it's a tutor for your child, do you want your child to be sort of taught in a certain language? AI will play a very critical role. So I think we need to add the educational institutions, the government, to invest into how can we use AI to preserve cultures and languages. Yeah.
And actually, we can see tendencies that smaller languages are not, you know, so popular ones spoken on the world don't get enough investment in any kind of AI technologies, or get investment to be well developed further or translated into, because there's not a market. So everything in the end ends up being market driven. But there's another side to all of that, even if I fully agree, and I do agree that certain AI tools are very, well, have opened up lots of opportunities for people with language barriers or whatever kind of concerns. But I do see it in my teaching with students that, I can now more or less, like, intuitively, immediately say if something is ChatGPT written or not. Because it's I can sometimes even learn it by heart, because it's always the same answers. And this takes away something. It takes away from a certain expressionism and even mistakes. Like, we sometimes don't speak in a perfect way, and that tells us a lot actually about the trustworthiness of another person. I just heard from a colleague that he said it's so funny that people have something like blushing, and that blushing is actually one form of gaining trust with the other. So, because if you blush, then you're the most vulnerable, because you cannot hide it. And it is supposed to be something like a biological principle of showing the others, I have nothing to hide, you know? So let's relate, or yeah, you can trust me. So there's so many different things in the idea of language where I'm sometimes a bit, even saddened that it might also become more streamlined in certain ways. I mean, I receive, again, the same text all over again, and I totally miss the voice of the student. Like, and I give everyone the full mark and the best marks if I see they made it themselves. I just want to see all the mistakes, all the issues, and because then I know I'm reading a human being. And this is something, not me being against technology, but it makes then also a certain human connection completely impossible, because I can never meet this student. I can never engage with them. We are talking or writing to each other, but we're not really, because they're streamlined and I read something that's not them. So, yeah.
Any more questions?
Yeah, she's
good. There was a lady in the back, I think.
I would like to jump on the train on the topic of language and translation and AI. Do you have any particular or personal expectations towards translation technologies or AI-assisted technologies in the future? Could also be personal hopes and wishes, but I'm just curious now with all the topics that came up.
Transport that to language, then you can maybe even see how the sort of, if we make it too easy to translate a language, then it might actually become harder to learn the language because you don't take the time anymore to suffer through learning all the words yourself, you know? So I am myself maybe happy that I still come from a time in which I learned certain things before AI, because it is really hard to imagine that you go through all the suffering and pain that is learning something new if you don't really have to, or if the machine does the outcome for you. So I think I'm a little bit more than the other two, like a little bit more apprehensive about its abilities to bring us further, because sometimes it also makes you further away from where you want to be.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. And but there are two sides, you know. On the one hand, there's a pragmatic way where it's totally useful, yeah, for certain things. And there are people in the world who really don't have enough access to certain structures. So for them, it might be amazing and great. So I'm not to judge, because for me, there's not so much at stake. However, I do see certain, tendencies of streamlining and of, as I said before. And I'm not quite sure, actually. I mean, one of the things I'm having lots of hope in is boredom. So I very much hope that we get bored, because I think humans get bored, and there is a certain redundancy, which is sometimes maybe okay. So I think maybe for certain texts or for certain formats in society, we can get, you know, AI to do things quicker, faster, all good. But for others, maybe not. The question is just who's going to access which ones, and is it going to be, again, the privileged going to get the good stuff, and the individual and the creative, the actual creative, or is it going to be for everyone? That's why I really don't like sometimes when Silicon Valley people say, oh, AI is democratizing everything. Well, not really. You're democratizing anyway on a kind of stolen product, but okay, that's another question. But you're also making sure maybe that certain people are not really developing certain skills they really need to be empowered, because they become dependent on technologies that might, by the way, just be switched off in a year or two. Who knows?
We have 5 more minutes, 1, maybe 2 more questions. No one? Oh, yes.
Hello. Is there anything I can do as an everyday human being to make the technologies work for me, not the other way around? Like, to enhance myself rather than let it do work for me and make me incapable of certain things that I would have learned otherwise? Like, how to... Is that a clear question?
So, it's interesting. I don't think it's that powerful to disable you from being you or do what you want. I think even that's another maybe idea. I mean, I totally get your question, by the way. And I find it really hard because, let's say, in the 90s, when the internet came up and became more and more and more like an infrastructure, people programming could also, you know, hack into certain things and individually really do a lot. At the moment with certain AI systems, they're so big. And for instance, one mistake sometimes that people do, and I get it, you know, it's kind of logical. If you, for instance, use things like ChatGPT and you prompt, and you think, oh, now I'm prompting better and more inclusive, and I totally, the system doesn't memorize anything. So it has to be retrained to memorize. So there's no way you can train it back. And one of my favorite, media philosophers, Willem Flusser, he once, already in the, I think, 70s or something, I mean, he had no idea AI is coming, but he talked or wrote a lot about computation. And his idea was, we are not just programming media and machines, they're also programming us. So I think even just this awareness makes things much more, easier to intervene with. And I wish I could say there's a playful way in just hacking AI or, I mean, certain AIs, but I'm not quite sure.
This reminds me of the podcast I was listening yesterday. This guy had a scammer or like an AI doppelganger that was used to call scammers and other like unhelpful sort of service personnel. And eventually this man started to like sound like his AI again, because we are also like picking up a lot of like the, like if ChatGPT tells something in a very specific way all the time, then eventually we are going to speak in that way a little bit ourselves as well. So that's also an interesting side effect.
Ms. Tongeri.
I wanted to say, You can use it to boost your productivity, depending on your profession. If you're coding, it can help you become a better coder. I'm not a marketer myself. I'm not good at copywriting, but sometimes when I have different programs and I know the themes and what I want to talk about, I'm able to use it to help me to communicate better so that I'm able to reach many more people. So I think it's a very powerful tool that is, especially LLMs specifically, that is making knowledge widely accessible. So you have the knowledge of a McKinsey consultant, a Deloitte consultant, or a Google engineer at your fingertips. So with the time you have, you just have to decide, what do I want to learn today, right? What's my speed of learning? How do I like learning? What are the different ways of learning? You can get all this different aspects. So I think it's very transformational that such technology is being made accessible to everyone, whether it's the free version or the paid version. And I think the companies are realizing how powerful these technologies are. Some of them, like OpenAI, are now talking about their discussions about they want to have subscription models of maybe up to 20,000 for a particular profession, whether it's a software developer or it's a consultant. So I think before we get there, before they start locking the systems, this is the time we have to, you know, fully maximize on the 100 billion parameter language models or the 500 billion parameter language models that we have. So there's a way of using it responsibly, but you have to fully maximize. At the end of the day, what are you bad at? What do you want to get better in? And how can this tool help you? So there's tremendous potential there.
Thank you. Many thanks to our three wonderful guests, Irma Mastenbrück, Eugenia Stamboliev, and Alfred Ongere. Thank you. Thank you for participating. And see you later at the festival.